On this episode of Newt's World, my guest is retired Army Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg. General Kellogg spent 1,462 days in the White House, serving with all four national security advisors to President Trump, longer than any other national security appointee. In that role, he was involved in every major national security decision by the president from 2017 to 2021. In his new book, War by Other Means, A General in the Trump White House, General Kellogg provides a discerning eyewitness account of those years and details President Trump's COVID-19 response, including the virus origins. He talks about the national security decisions around North Korea and Russia and the development of Trump's Afghanistan plan and Biden's mishandling of the exit. He also describes what happened in the White House as the events of January 6th unfolded. Here to tell us more about his experience in the Trump White House, I'm really pleased to welcome my guest and my longtime friend, General Keith Kellogg. He's dedicated his life to national service with tours of duty in Vietnam, Panama, and Iraq, as well as commanding the 82nd Airborne Division before serving in the White House. You know, you and I go back, we were just talking about it, I think to 1987 or so at Fort Irwin. And if I call you Keith, and I hope you'll call me Newt, I want people to know it's not because I don't have enormous respect for you as a general, but we're just friends. And every time I'd go in to see Vice President Pence, you and I would bounce into each other, and you were always in the middle of almost every major thing. So I happen to think war by other means is a really, really important concept, which I think all too many of our national security people, both in the Pentagon and out, don't understand. But before we get to that, I'm just curious, given your background in the Army, and as you know, my dad spent 27 years in the infantry, what to you was the biggest surprise of seeing the world from the White House rather than from an Army base?
Now, I'm going to be talking about the Trump White House, Mr. Speaker. The biggest surprise I had was the absolute resistance that I ran into, and we all ran into, when we were in the White House with the Trump administration. You know, we walked in there thinking, after the 2016 campaign, that everybody would come together, we'd kind of be, okay, be typical bare knuckles fighting, politically speaking, but never resistance to the level that I saw. And it was almost like this was not the America that I read about, looked at, thought about, had spent time in the military, even in the business world, the resistance that President Trump faced. It was interesting because his daughter Ivanka said to me after about a year, I never realized Washington would be this nasty. We all kind of ran into the same things, like, geez, why is this happening? And I think part of it was, and I hate to say this, but the president ran a very populist campaign. He was looking out for people in Washington, Kansas, not Washington, D.C. And I think there's a real hardcore organization in Washington, D.C. that does not want to give up any type of power to the people out in the, you know, in the flyover states or anywhere else in the United States.
And we've seen some of that really permeate. When you hear that the FBI is going to investigate parents for complaining at a school board meeting, something has gone really seriously wrong in how America is operating. Now, you swore to uphold the Constitution and to protect the country from enemies, foreign and domestic. You also were right in the center of trying to develop President Trump's Afghanistan plan. I'm sure, like me, you were totally appalled by the way that Biden collapsed totally. But tell us for a couple minutes from your perspective, how would it have been different had President Trump still been in charge?
When we came into the White House, the president said, even during the 2016 campaign, that we were going to get out of Afghanistan, but we were going to get out in a reasonable manner. We talked about it on the campaign plan and when he first came in. And, of course, we had the succession of national security advisors that some were against it and some were for it. You know, McMaster was terribly against it and Bolton was terribly against it. And at least O'Brien and I kind of worked side by side to get out of Afghanistan. But we wanted to do it in a reasonable manner. And here's the big difference. And it took us 2 years to finally get the plan in place that we wanted to work. And how it all started is we first said we have to have somebody we can work with, the Taliban. So we reached out to the Pakistanis who had put the Mullah Baradar in jail We said, let's get him out of jail and put him as part of the Taliban negotiating team. So we went to Prime Minister Khan to please release him, and he did to us. And then he sent in to Doha, and he became part of the negotiating team with our representative, Zal Khalilzad, who we put in place after 2 years, after a lot of resistance from earlier people. And they started working on this plan of how to get out in a negotiated way, because we thought the only way you're going to get out of Afghanistan properly is to have a negotiated settlement. So they went back and forth, and finally we came up with what we called the Doha Proclamation, which was signed February 29, 2020, which set a certain number of conditions out there. The first condition was the most important, and that it would be a reconciliation government between the Ghani government and the Taliban. And until that was done, we weren't going to withdraw any of the forces. We were going to put a floor on the forces of 2,500, well over 3,000 paramilitary under Gina Haspel and the CIA. We keep the NATO structure there, and we keep the air bases there as well, Bagram Air Base, until all the conditions were made. We used 1 May as a forcing function, not as a date certain. So we had this agreement with the Taliban, and they said, well, we're not going to attack any U.S. forces while this is going on, and they didn't. Not a single American was killed from February of 2020 till 20 January after we had left. I can't talk after that, but they didn't kill anybody. They knew that we were going to negotiate to come out of there. The impediment we had to progress was actually Ghani, because Ghani did not want to negotiate at all with the Taliban. We kind of kept enforcing him to do it. So we said, okay, this is the way it's going to be. This is the way it's going to work. Where I think the mistake was made is that Biden did not follow through on any discussions we have with the Taliban. Here's a great example. On the 4th of March, which is 3 days after we signed the Doha Declaration, or Zal Khalilzad did, Trump picked up the phone, and he called Mullah Baradar, who's the chief negotiator for the Taliban, and told him in no uncertain terms, and I was in the Oval Office when he told him, that this is what's going to happen if you do not fulfill this agreement going forward, and we know where you live. And in fact, I sat there thinking, this is being translated. I wonder how it's being even translated, because it was such a strong set of language. And it was a forcing function. It was forcing respect for broader than respect the United States of America. And they didn't attack any U.S. forces the entire time it happened. So what happened is when Biden came in, we told him what they had. We told him what the agreement that we were working with. He kept Zal Khalilzad as the negotiator there, but he never picked up the phone. He never called Baradar. And then he just established a date certain. We had told him earlier, don't do that. Tell him it's a moving target. Until they meet these conditions, that target would not be met on full withdrawal. You will keep those forces in place. And the hidden secret in all of this, though, was when the election changed who was going to be in the White House, we know that Ghani said, don't negotiate any further. He told his chief negotiator, Abdullah Abdullah, don't negotiate. Stall. And by him stalling, Baradar picked up on it. Biden did not pick up the phone and call the Taliban to talk to him about it. And after a period of time, actually after 1 May, Baradar just said, game on. And they just unleashed him. And then the Taliban went for broke, and then you saw what was going to happen. So what I saw was absolutely imbecilic decisions by the president and his national security advisors and national security team. Vice President Pence made a comment on television just the other night. He said, this never had to happen. And it didn't, because we had a pretty well set plan to get out of there properly. And there was a number we had never draw down from, which was 2,500, which was agreed to by everybody. It was agreed to by the Defense Department, by the CIA, all of the intelligence communities, by the State Department. And we knew we could hold at 2,500 and still maintain some balance in there, supported again by Gene Haspel's 3,500. It's a long answer to a pretty short question, but that's kind of how we got to where we were at. And then when they decided to get out of there in a hurry, everything just fell apart.
I'm curious, you had a major role in trying to stand up the new Iraqi system after the war when we'd occupied Iraq. So you'd seen the challenges in one particular overwhelmingly Muslim country. And then, of course, from a White House vantage point, you were looking at the challenges in Afghanistan. How would you compare the two, just in terms of the difficulty of getting things done?
With Iraq, you at least had a relatively stable government backed by a lot of U.S. forces, more forces than a lot of people realize. That we kept forces there, we kept the base there. You know, we kept Al-Asad Air Base. Think Al-Asad, think of Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And we also had more of a compliant government that was willing to work with us. We had Prime Minister Kadhimi come over, you know, the current prime minister in Iraq, He was very friendly. This is what he wanted to do. It was a very open discussion. We sat in the cabinet room with his entire team. This is what we want to have happen. This is where we want to go. Even though it's a little bit of a tough relationship, it's a relationship built on a lot of respect. And when ISIS came into play in Iraq and also Syria, we fell in a lot of military forces to support him in defeating ISIS going forward. You know, ISIS was created, frankly, because of the Obama administration. You know, when they basically said, I remember ISIS was a JV team. They went out there and started, they controlled Mosul, and then they went over to Raqqa in Syria. We put a lot of military troops and forces on top of that and helped the Iraqis defeat that. So it was a much more compliant government. They were much more friendly to the United States. They were willing to work it. And there was a level of respect between both of us. We reached out to every single party in Iraq, to include Sadr. Muqtada Sadr maybe didn't like the Americans, but he at least respected the Americans and the force we had there. So there was a level of trust and respect that we never got with the Ghani government. And we actually were working better with the Taliban than we were with the Ghani government at the end. And that was kind of a little bit of dark humor.
It was startling how rapidly Ghani left the country and how much money he took with him. Do you think he had always planned that kind of escape opportunity?
Look, I had no faith at all in Ghani. Trump didn't. Pence didn't. None of us had trust and confidence in Ghani. And we had actually, through Zal Khalilzad, our special representative, had basically told Ghani he was not going to be part of a government of national reconciliation. He was going to be gone out there. When he came to the White House with President Biden, you know, Biden did not read him the Riot Act. That's what he should have done. He brought in his chief negotiator with him, Abdullah Abdullah. They sat in the Oval Office, and it was just everybody seemed to be happy. It was going fine, swimmingly. And he should have taken that opportunity, he, Biden, and lay down the law to Ghani on what would happen. Because right after that meeting, you could see where the Taliban really, really increased the pressure going forward. In fact, the indications we got, and I stayed in constant contact with Zal, that the Taliban actually were very, very surprised how fast it actually moved forward on them taking over Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing collapsed so rapidly, they could barely get to the next town before it surrendered. But that's what happens when morale breaks and people lose faith. We had designed an Afghan army that required American support and required competent air power. And then when we pulled the legs out from under it, very much like what happened in Vietnam in 75, when word spreads that we're going to lose, people start to collapse. And of course, then to have the president of your country leave with a couple $100 million has to be a disgusting sense of this is over. And I wish there was a way to go after the money, because I'm sure most of the money he stole was ours. I get the sense that Afghanistan was vastly more corrupt than Iraq, that from the very beginning, we found it really hard to find partners who were not willing to be, in effect, either rented or bought. And a great deal of our aid money went into a system in which the corruption was open and normal. It wasn't like it was unusual. It was an expected part of the society.
Yeah, you're right. I really believe you're correct on it. It's more corrupt. But here's the other one, former military guy. I kind of hate to say this, but we just kept lying to ourselves. We kept lying to ourselves for 20 years that everything was fine. We knew what was going on. We know what was happening there. And for 20 years, actually, I say 18, because I think the first 2 years we were in Afghanistan were righteous. We went after Osama bin Laden. You know, we put KSM in Guantanamo. And we did everything right. Then for the next 18 years, we started doing things that I think were kind of stupid. And we kind of allowed that to happen. We didn't throw the flag and say, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. We kind of said, okay, we know there's corruption. Let's just continue to go with it. And I blame a lot of people who I've known for years, a lot of senior military officers, many of them retired, that you kept pushing this narrative for everybody going along, that everything was going to be fine. Next year, we're turning the corner. Just give me another dollar. Just give me another pint of blood. Just a little more time going forward. We said, look, these people are corrupt. We know they're corrupt. We've been paying money. We're paying their military, and it's almost like it's a ghost army. You know, a lot of people said once you pay them on a payday, you didn't see them for another month. And we kept pushing that. And I think by in that regard, and I know the language is strong, we lied to the American people. We were telling them everything was fine when it really wasn't fine. We were backing up a corrupt government. We allowed it to happen, and I think what happened, we got so fixated on Afghanistan, we lost our strategic, I think, focus in the military, and that is one of the reasons why I think we kind of lost the march on what the Chinese were doing and also the Russians were doing with a lot of our research and technology going forward. Because we were so focused on this terrorism, counterterrorism issue in Afghanistan, when actually the terrorist threat was growing outside of Afghanistan, in Africa and other places in the Middle East.
We did a podcast recently with the Washington Post reporter who just published a book called The Afghanistan Papers. And he had actually found that there was a special office of the Inspector General for Afghanistan, and they had been gathering exactly what you said. I mean, they had 20 years of internal, pretty candid comments by many senior officers who said, we don't know what's going on, we don't understand it, our metrics are nonsense. I mean, it's a remarkable indictment of the core system. And in my mind, having grown up in the old army that had fought World War II in Korea and had a real sense of commitment to the country and a real toughness because they'd been in such big fights, you know, I look at Milley as the ultimate product of 18 years of decay internally, and I'm astonished at a number of the things he's doing. But I'm curious, both from your national security background, but also from your long career in the U.S. Army, what's your reaction to the current process that's underway in the Pentagon?
Mark Milley and I go back probably 25 years. We were officers together in the invasion of Panama during Operation Just Cause. I've known him for years. And in the last 6 months, I sent him a note. I never got a response, by the way. I said, I think your actions are actually seditious. And I think you should leave as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think he has become incredibly polarized and political. And it's something I never saw from Colin Powell to Hugh Shelton to Dick Myers to Pete Pace to Joe Dunford. He's taken a role that is incredibly, incredibly political. And I think he forgot what his primary role is, was a principal military advisor to the president, to the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. And it really struck me when he made a comment on the 8th of January call to the Chinese when he said, well, I told Mike Pompeo and I told Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of the White House. And my immediate reaction was, as far as I know, that's not in your duty description. You're not the principal military advisor to Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of the White House. You're the principal military advisor to the president. You never even told him about your call. And because of that, I would have fired him immediately. I think he should have been gone. I think he'd become very political and working with it. And I think that's now permeated down the chain. People see that. People know what's going on. I think he forgot what his primary role was, which is to deter, and if deterrence fails, fight to win our nation's wars. Unfortunately, I think, and this is one of the byproducts of Afghanistan in the 20-year war, I think the senior levels of the officer corps are kind of the same way now. They become very, very politicized in how they're going forward. I remember reading Pogue's 4 books on George C. Marshall and what George C. Marshall did in 1940 when he basically stripped the senior leaders out of the army in the senior military and replaced them with more junior, more agile officers. And that's one of the reasons Dwight D. Eisenhower moved up 350 positions almost overnight. And maybe if I was king for a day, that's where I'd probably come in and say, maybe we ought to do that. Maybe we ought to strip out the 4 and 3 stars and say, let's start all over again and rebuild it. And let's build a military that will fight and win our nation's wars. I know it's a harsh comment, but I actually believe there's some merit to it.
I've always been fascinated because I think people really underestimate how much Marshall reshaped the entire War Department before the war. And you're exactly right. You have a guy like Eisenhower go from lieutenant colonel to 3 stars at a speed that must have been almost like, he must have felt at times like he had to slow down and decompress because the changes were so quick. But Marshall was doing that across the board and had a little book he'd collected for like 20 years of what he thought were the young, hard chargers. And he kept promoting them. And the result was a dramatically more agile military than we'd had before that. But I'm curious, you're sitting in the White House. You see all the stuff going by you. You have the intelligence community, the State Department, the Defense Department, to some extent Treasury, all of them having an impact on what's going on. How much different is the view from the national security standpoint in the White House from anything you'd experienced before that?
There was no comparison at all. it was a massive jump because the decisions you're making when you're in the Oval Office with the president or in the national security meetings in the Situation Room, you have to realize these are significant decisions that are well above you'd seen before. And they really are, because not just the importance of it, but the speed in which they need to be made. Here was the kind of way I explained it to some people when I would bring people in the National Security Council when I'd interview them. I said, look, there's no room for training wheels in this organization. You're ready to go right away. But they said, understand that when a crisis occurs for the president and for the United States, you're already behind the curve because the other side already has initiated something and you are responding to what they've initiated. So you must immediately come up to speed and then accelerate and get ahead of where they were at. And those decisions have to be made rapidly with a lot of confidence and give them options because you are committing, for the most part, the national security of the United States and all the instruments that are inherent in that with the military and the State Department and everything else. Sort of like the old wire diagram in the military. I used to show people, guys, there's nobody above us. We're the top block in the wire diagram. There's nobody that you're going to have to ask questions of. You got to make those decisions really rapidly. That's the reason why I thought it was tremendously interesting to me, and I think it was really illustrative. When I saw what was happening in Afghanistan recently, I showed pictures of President Biden up at Camp David by himself without his national security team. We had a rule. It was an unspoken rule. But if something happened in the White House and a crisis occurred, everybody would collapse on the president and vice president. You were there. You didn't ask permission. You walked into the Oval or you walked into the sit room, all the senior members out there, because you knew right away the rapidity of the decisions that you had to make were very, very important because you cannot wait. Time will kill you. And weakness is a threat for anything going forward because weakness actually creates the adversary to make more and more tough decisions. And when I mean by rapidity of decision, I'll just give you one example. When we went after Soleimani, we went into the president. We actually went into the Yellow Oval up in the residence, and we're talking to him about it. And, you know, a lot of people think, okay, we'll come back with a couple of recommendations, see what you think. He made that decision that day, that morning, let's get Soleimani. And the policy behind that was super escalation. And a lot of time in the government, what I found in other organizations, like when you're in defense, that people go incremental escalation. Okay, if they did this, you would do this. One step up, one step up. He believed, and I really recommended to him, what I called super escalation. If they do something at this level, you go six or seven levels above that immediately. And you send a message to them, your survival as a nation is at stake if you want to keep pushing this. And that's what we did with Soleimani. We basically told the Iranian government, the supreme leader, you're on the list. You're next. And we're going to come after you. And their response showed they got that because their response after we killed Soleimani was to basically fire some missiles into the desert near Al-Asad Air Base that didn't kill anybody or hurt anybody. And they told us in advance, this is what we're going to do. We're going to miss you guys. And a lot of people in the Situation Room that day didn't believe they really meant what they said, but they did it. And because of that, the president sitting in the sit room thought what was going on, said, okay, we're done. And that to me is the decision making that is so much different than everywhere else that you see in any other government organization.
You know, along that same line, and I've heard Trump talk about this, that the going after the head of ISIS, Baghdadi, and then going after Soleimani, in a way set the stage for the Taliban taking Trump very, very seriously because they'd seen what he'd done. It was a fact. It wasn't rhetoric or posturing. Did you have that same feeling that he was beginning to be dealt with as a force that was vastly more capable than the people were interacting with, and that because he was prepared to use it, it gave him an unusual level of leverage?
President Trump was fearless in the use of force. He would listen. He didn't like it when I told him this. I said, well, you're a reluctant warrior. And he got a little bit angry. I said, no, wait a second. That's a compliment because this means I know as a former military guy, you will use force only when absolutely necessary. You will commit it. But when you do commit it, you commit it with overwhelming force going forward. And a lot of times he overruled Mattis, he overruled Dunford, who were always very incremental. They said, well, let's just raise it a little bit higher, you know, sort of a quid pro quo. And his point was always go a lot higher and hit him hard and make him understand that. And he actually, and all presidents do, he really grew into his position. He kind of understood it more and more, and he understood the importance of the use of force, not only going after Baghdadi, but also when he went after Soleimani. But even earlier with that, when he fired missiles into Syria, when they used nerve gas, when, remember, Obama had the famous red line, well, if they cross this red line and use nerve gas, we're going to go after them. Well, they crossed that red line. And I remember sitting in the Situation Room with him when we were talking about it. I said, you know, Mr. President, I'm going to make it real clear to you. You know, they use sarin nerve gas. We know they use it on their civilians. And said, this was a nerve gas developed by the Nazis in World War II. And it was such an egregious weapon that the Nazis never even used it. And I said, and here they're using it against civilians. You've got to make a stand and make a point. And he said, yeah, let's do it. So when Mattis came in, he said, well, this is where we want to go and use this and so many missiles. We upped the missiles. But at that time, the president even wanted to make it a much stronger strike. We didn't. And the lesson he learned from that was, I think my generals were more cautious than I am. And I said, well, they are, because that's how they kind of look at it. I believe in this thing called, what I said earlier, super escalation. And he started to really believe in that and started to understand that. And he unleashed the military forces that he had. And I think because of that, everybody, and I don't care who it was, I don't care if it's the supreme leader in Iran or Putin or Xi, they all saw what he was trying to do, including Kim Jong-un. And Kim Jong-un saw that as well. They all kind of understood, okay, this guy is serious, and he is willing to use force, and he doesn't have any limits. And what he means by limits, he's not afraid to go to levels that we have never seen before. And I think President Trump did that. I think he protected the United States. I think people were afraid to go after it. Look, we never had a single Chinese aircraft sortie approach Taiwan like the 150 that just approached last week. That never happened, because he made it very clear to Xi, don't go there. You know, carrier battle group 5 out of the 7th Fleet will show up on your doorstep right in the middle of the Taiwan Straits if that's what you want to do. And he was pretty clear. Not only did he grow in the job, but it was the way he believed in the use of military force, and he thought that force would prevail and he forced respect.
He also had an ability to sort of take risk at the margin. I'm curious, when he stepped over into North Korea, which I think was symbolically a big deal in North Korea, had that been thought through, or was that just an intuitive response to the conversation?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to say it was thought through. It wasn't. It was intuitive. It almost felt like he was treating Kim like a younger brother, like, let me show you the way to govern going forward. And Kim, it took time, and it took some confidence and faith. But after a while, Kim picked up on that. And Kim started to have this level of trust and understanding. And I think, by the way, it's carried over now, even with North Korea, because we saw his last military parade. We didn't have any new weapons being shown. It was primarily a health parade more than anything else. He saw that. And by the way, the president did with others as well, like Macron, who treated, I thought, like another younger brother. Kim saw that, and I think because of that, the tensions really dropped off on that. I think if Trump had stayed in, we would have had some type of agreement with North Korea this year. By the way, what's interesting is everybody pushed back on Trump on the way he dealt with North Korea. John Bolton did. You had McMaster. You had all of them out there saying, this is not the way to go. And he said, no, I'm going to treat this guy as a human being and sit and talk to him and see if we can have some type of understanding. And because of that, especially in the last year, there were some pretty good relations. And I think we had a breakthrough. And here's what's interesting. What the president was pushing was economics. He said, you know, you can keep raising weapons and we'll keep raising weapons. And you add more weapons and we'll add more weapons. But we can help you economically. We can get you out of where you're at today and going forward economically and have you look like South Korea and become an economic powerhouse. And that resonated with him. And I think if you see what Kim Jong-un's doing today, it is much more economically based than military based. So I think Trump kind of, these personal relationships, which he believed very, very important in how he led, his whole idea was, if I can establish a personal relationship with people, I don't care if it's Putin, if it's Xi, it's Kim Jong-un, or whomever, I think we can get further along in trying to make this a safer world. And I think he was right. There was a lot of people who didn't agree with him, but he believed personal leverage was very, very important.
I was recently with former Secretary of State Pompeo, who gets very emotional talking about having gone into North Korea and gotten three people who had been held hostage for a long time and had been prisoners. And he saw that all as part of the Trump effect, that you had a gradual opening up and willingness to cooperate coming out of North Korea that we'd really never seen before.
Again, that's all President Trump. And I really believe he said this is the way to go forward. When you came into the White House, you asked a question earlier about, it was interesting to me watching the, for lack of a better term, the old guard. People say, no, this isn't the way you get forward with North Korea or anybody else. He said, everybody knows I'm willing to walk away from a bad deal. Kim Jong-un found that the hard way when we actually walked away from a deal in Hanoi, when he just actually left lunch on the table and walked out the door, got in his airplane, and flew home, which stunned Kim Jong-un. And, you know, all the reports we got later that he was very, very surprised this happened. But he made the point, if I don't get a good deal, I'm not going to stick around and talk to you and have lunch with you. And I really believe that was important. You know, Mike Pompeo, to his credit, he was the one who actually brokered the deal to finally get them together. It all worked together because he and the president basically worked arm in arm to get this going forward. And I just saw it, and I think it worked. I think the old guard was stunned by it. Here's what's interesting. They've gone back to the old ways now. I mean, if you look at what Biden has done, he's reverted to form of everything that had been done before. And I don't think he's going to be successful at all in anything.
Well, you know, you had the same thing happening in the Middle East where people who had 20 and 30 years invested in a particular approach which kept failing were, I think, deeply offended that the Trump approach actually was working. It's kind of weird, but he was doing things that they deeply opposed and that sort of repudiated 20 years or 25 years of failure. And I suspect they will try to undermine it and go back to the old order now because it's somehow their professional reputations require that we do things that are stupid because that's what everybody then applauds.
Well, you know, going back to the Kerry approach when he was the Secretary of State, here's what's interesting. The day the Abraham Accords were signed in the South Lawn in the White House, there was a lunch afterwards. And I sat next to Tony Blair, the former United Kingdom Prime Minister. And he looked at me and he said, you guys got this one right. And I go, you know, excuse me? He said, you approach this from totally different way we'd ever thought about approaching it, which is basically a go after all of the other outliers that are out there to have a good economic relationship with Israel, and eventually the Palestinians will come your way. All the rest of us kept saying, if you don't go through the Palestinians first, you'll never get any success. You turned it on its head and you reversed it. And later we saw Bibi Netanyahu, and he said in the Blair House, said exactly the same thing. And I think Trump saw that, and Jared Kushner helped work that with all that work on the Abraham Accords. And I thought we started to turn the Middle East towards a more economic view of the world than a military view of the world. And that's where I keep going back. You know, I said that comment earlier that the president was a reluctant warrior. He really believed in the use of policy and personal relationships to get stuff done. He knew he always had the military hammer. He always knew that. And he always knew he could use it. But he approached it differently. That's the reason the Abraham Accords, I think, worked pretty well. That's when you see some pretty good economic work between the UAE and Israel going forward. And just as an aside, because I think you'll appreciate this one, you know, when we were talking with Afghanistan, he talked at one time about bringing all of the members in the discussions to Camp David. And you see that in the press out there. People basically fell on the floor in the Situation Room when he said, I'm going to bring the Taliban and Ghani to Camp David. And I said, wait, stop, guys. Because I said, you guys have forgot your history. I said, Carter did that. He did it with Menachem Begin and he did Anwar Sadat. He took him to Camp David. You know, he basically fed him cold pizza and warm beer. And for 12 days, they hammered out the Camp David Accords. That's where the president comes from. And I said, he has an interesting view of the world that is totally contrary to what you see, and you saw that in the Middle East, something that nobody else has done previously because he thought that method was wrong.
Given the centrality of Trump to all this, how much did all of the continuous effort over impeachment and investigations and what have you, how much did that distract from focusing on the issues of national security?
I think it took a tremendous toll. But to give credit to the president, he kept fighting through it. But, you know, for 4 years, we felt we were under siege in the White House. It was almost like every single day you walked in the door and somebody was coming after you. They wanted to impeach him before his inauguration. And because of that, we had to fight every single day, both a personal battle, a public relations battle going forward. And it takes a toll on you because you're constantly under pressure. And the pressures in the White House, and you know that from being around here in Washington, D.C., are absolutely enormous. and you have to have focus, and you have to fight your way to make sure that you have good focus and fight your way into that mindset going forward. And then when you add on not only impeachment, but then when you added on coronavirus that hit afterwards, and then you have an election year going forward, I have no idea, very candidly, I don't know how he made it through that year. But yet he always kept a good sense of humor. You know, I used to say, people, you don't understand President Trump. When I wrote the book, I wanted to actually title it Behind Closed Doors, because when he was one-on-one, you'd sit with him in the Oval Office, you'd sit with talk to him, and you know that. He was a little bit of a different person when he went in front of the Klieg lights, and I said, whoa, who's that guy out there? But it was enormous distraction, and I think it hurt America because it helped to divide America. And some of the stuff was just absolutely garbage. When I was called in front of the Mueller Commission on the Russiagate issue, I was the first guy at the White House to go sit in front of the Mueller team. And I sat down with him. By the way, I didn't even take a lawyer, which President Trump to this day says, I can't believe it, what an idiot you are. But I said, no, my dad told me once, just tell the truth. You only need to have one story in your mind instead of two. But I sat down with him. I said, look, you don't understand that during the election, 2016, we only had 80 people in the election team total, well under the 300 that Hillary had there in New York City. I said, we couldn't even collude among ourselves half the time, let alone collude with the Russians. There was nothing going on. But yet we had to fight through that the whole way. And here's the impact on that. He wanted to reach out to Putin because he thought it was important we talk to the Russians. There was a lot of things we could have done with the Russians going forward. And Putin knew that. You know, when the coronavirus was going on, we were very concerned about Putin's national security team getting the virus. We had the Abbott point of care where you could test right away with Abbott. Well, we sent him some of those devices because we knew we didn't have them. And the reason we sent him the Abbott devices was to make sure he could test his national security team, because we need to keep them up and running. Putin made a comment to him. He said during a phone call, you know, Mr. President, please don't tell anybody you sent us these. And the president said, well, okay, but why? He said, because it'll just put another nail in your coffin on people distrusting Russia. And in other words, we tried to do something that was positive from a national security viewpoint to make sure his national security team was solid and he was okay. And yet he was so concerned, he even saw from his viewpoint that all the press wanted was to bring him down, and this would just be another nail they would use on him. And I thought this was the distraction we faced on the first year, the second year, the third year, then we had coronavirus. So a long answer to a short question, dude. It was a constant battle. We just had to fight our way through it. And I think to a credit to a lot of people there, they were able to fight through it, and a credit to Donald Trump that he was able to work through it as well. I understand he had heard some pretty harsh tweets, but I thought the policies were pretty good for 4 years.
I've had a similar experience to yours, although I wasn't with him nearly as much as you were. When the door closed, he would shift into asking questions, telling stories, trying to make things work in his own head. And he was substantially more engaging person than when he was in front of a TV camera. Sort of the entertainer took over when the TV lights went on.
To me, he was very Socratic in his decision-making. I remember one of the very first times we were in the Situation Room, we went around the room. He would have a way of asking questions. And if you were in the room, you were going to get asked a question. You were there. You were going to talk. And I remember I was sitting there one of the very first times, and a young woman two seats down from me in the sit room, the president said, well, what's your opinion? And she goes, Mr. President, I'm just a note taker. He goes, you're in the room. What's your opinion? And he would do that. And he would go around and ask these questions. And I think in his mind, he was trying to get not only a sense of the room, but firm up what he believed. I used to constantly tell him, Mr. President, trust your instincts. They're really, really, really good. And I really, you know, grew to admire the way he made those decisions, because they were not one-off decisions. He would sit down, he would listen, and he actually did listen to him. You know, I remember during the coronavirus, people said, well, listen to the doctors. We had 7 doctors on the coronavirus task force, 7. And we listened to them all the time. Sometimes I think we listened to them too much. But he would always listen. He would sit there in the Oval Office or in the Situation Room or one-on-one, and he would make these comments. And one time he made a comment during the height of the coronavirus task force, and he just looked at me and goes, you know, I just want Americans to get better. And I said, Mr. President, why don't you go out and say it just that way to the American people? He said, no, they want a strong leader out there. He just looked at this 2 different ways, and he believed in strength and having strength and portraying that to the American people. And he wanted them, they had a strong leader in charge. And I think he did that. But there was also a side I saw him that I grew to really, really admire, that I said, I wish more Americans saw him than I saw him after not just 4 years, but almost 6 years counting the campaign going forward.
You were one of the few people who had a really broad background who joined the campaign early. What attracted you to it? Why did you decide to do that?
Because I thought he was speaking to Americans when I was listening to him. And I actually did my homework. I read his books. You know, I read everything that he'd written and seen what he said. And I said, this is a guy who kind of speaks to the American people. He really is. He's a guy that came out of Queens. Everybody thinks he came as a New York billionaire. He's a different type of person. And then I talked to him. I said, you know, this is the kind of guy that you can just sit down and have a beer with if you want. And he doesn't drink at all. He doesn't drink or smoke. But I said, this was a guy that he really spoke instinctively. He knew what the American people were at. And I think he got that, Newt, because all of his years as a builder, he would go talk to the waiters. He would go talk to the plumbers. He'd go talk to the people building stuff. And he got a feel for the common people. I really picked up on that. It was almost like being in the military when good commanders would always talk to the privates. And he had a connection with the American people. I mean, where else does somebody draw 45,000 or 30,000 or 15,000 people at a rally? Name me another politician that does that consistently. He's the only guy that has done that consistently, not only the first campaign as president and then currently, which you see now.
I used to always tell people that it's a big mistake to think of Trump as a billionaire in the finance sense. Trump was in the construction and management system, and he happened to make money at it, but his natural instinct is to talk to people. I've watched him all over the place. I knew him for many years before he ran, and Clifton and I belonged to Trump National. And you'd see him, you know, he talked to the groundskeeper, he talked to the golf pro, he talked to the guests. He had a constant interest in how things are going, and there's a very funny YouTube series that was made sometime, I think, in the 90s, where Trump takes one of his hotels and he does every job in the hotel. So you have a video of Trump meeting people at the door dressed like the guy who's supposed to be at the door. And then Trump is with the maids vacuuming a room. And it ends with him walking a dog and coming back and giving the dog to the lady and looking at her and saying, "Do I get a tip?" And it's just, you know, it's just kind of perfect. I want to thank you. You have served this country in so many different ways. You represent, I think, the best of the Army in that you understood your job was to be a true professional and that you served at the command of the civilians. And it's the military we got to get back to. And then I watched you up close for 4 years, really serving the country in the White House. And I think that your willingness to put aside your ego and to simply be an implementer helping is a remarkable thing. And I think that both the president and the vice president were very lucky, and the country was very lucky, to have you there. And I want to thank you for joining me. Your account of your years serving the Trump White House, I think, is going to prove historically valuable because you don't approach it with any kind of particular bias. You're reporting to the country. And I want our listeners to know that we're going to have a link to pre-order your book, War by Other Means, The General in the Trump White House, on our show page at newsworld.com. And it comes out on Tuesday, October 19th. And Keith, I really want to thank you personally for taking the time to help educate me and hopefully those who listen.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to my guest, General Keith Kellogg. You can get a link to buy his new book, War by Other Means, A General in the Trump White House, on our show page at newsworld.com. NewsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying NewsWorld, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcast and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.